Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
Nancy, this has just been the most amazing experience. I have loved chatting with you. I love diving deep into things, and you managed to pull things out of me that I didn't even know I felt. And it's always great because I love learning and moving forward. And this has just been an absolute pleasure.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Today's mentor guest is Allison Cromie of Cromie Creative Consultants. I invited Allison into this conversation to discuss her transformational journey to live and work authentically while building a marketing firm in the health and wellness space. And there's so much more we're going to unpack in her backstory. It'll be a bit surprising, not to her, but to you and I, because she's been through a lot. And so it's going to be a wonderfully shaped conversation that I think will land nicely with how we flow and roll out the conversation. So, you know, grab a cup of coffee or pull over, or you can listen while you're driving. And if you need to pull over in the middle, do that. Or whatever you're doing, just kind of settle into the conversation. I'll invite Allison in. Hi, Allison.
Hello, Nancy. How are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm really excited, open-hearted, realistic, and receptive to learning more about you and kind of flowing with the conversation. There's also a lot where I'm going to learn, so I'm excited about that. How are you feeling?
I'm great. I'm so excited about having this conversation today.
Okay, very good. And where in Minnesota am I reaching you at?
So I am in Burnsville, Minnesota, and that's where my office is, but I live in both Farmington and in Columbia Heights.
Okay. Two residences.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I have two residences, and I will get into this more in my story a little later, but that's definitely a big part of my background and what we're talking about today. So,
okay, good. Well, to start, Allison Cromie started Cromie Creative Consultants in 2019 after working with clients through a small agency for almost 6 years. She holds a Bachelor of Arts from Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and has continued her education by taking courses and surrounding herself with mentors along the way. Allison and her team love to strategize website redesigns by looking at marketing through a holistic lens before executing a cohesive marketing plan. What patterns of success are emerging in your given industry? Her team partners with wellness practitioners to get found in searches, fill their schedules, and deliberately grow their practices through ads, social media, email marketing, content development, SEO, web design. Not sure where you're going to start? We'll start by getting an audit. You can go to her website at cromiecreativeconsultants.com. All right. Well, let's start at the beginning of what it was like growing up in your home. So tell us a little bit about your home. Who was in your home growing up and how you would describe your parents with 4 to 6 words?
Yeah. So growing up, at least in the early part of my life, I grew up with my mom and my dad, and I have a biological sister who is about 3 years younger than me. But what's interesting about our family is that my dad had been married
before he met my mom and had children from that marriage. My dad was, I think, 12 years older than my mom. So I had half brothers and sisters from that who at various points in our life lived with us. My mom, I describe as a very creative, down-to-earth, very strong person. She was always the one we kind of went out and had fun with. But, you know, looking back, especially now that I have children of my own, she's very human. That's I think I look back and think about all the mistakes that I make with my kids, and I'm like, oh, yeah, yep, she did those too. So
how many kids do you have?
I have two. I have two boys.
Okay. And what ages are they?
Right now they are 7 and 10. So we're in a really fun age.
Yeah. Very active too.
Yes. Yeah. Very much
different
so.
Type of active than when they're toddlers.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course, now we're getting to the point where my 10-year-old is going on 15. So that's a whole new set of challenges.
Wow. Okay. And tell us, describe a little bit more of your dad's characteristics.
Yeah. So my dad, again, he was older than my mom, and he was also, he was on disability for most of my life. But he was a very real person, was forgiving, but also very quick to judge. But I say quick to judge and reasonable, because after you made your case to him, he would always come around, which I loved about him. So even though there were times where he was very kind of judgmental right away, it was like, well, Dad, have you thought about it this way? And he's like, oh, okay, you make a good point. But he was also, despite the fact that he was on disability, he was very hardworking. He always had things going. And he was a very religious person as well.
Mm. Is he still with you?
He is not, unfortunately. He passed about 3 years ago from pancreatic cancer.
Okay. Wow. Did he have a long struggle with that?
So no, actually, he, although he was probably struggling with it longer than we knew, he actually passed 2 weeks after he was diagnosed.
Oh.
And the family was very involved in that transition, and we decided to hospice him at home. And it was actually a really amazing time where we got to come together as a family.
Mm. Oh, that's nice. So your parents had been divorced a long time?
Yeah. So at that, my parents divorced when I was in first grade. So my mom they got divorced. My mom got married and divorced a few more times. And my dad ended up marrying a wonderful woman. And she brought her own children to the relationship as well. So I ended up with another couple stepbrothers mm-hmm. out of this. So it was always a very large family. Most of my half and step brothers and sisters were older than me, but they were still part of that household at various points in that life. So, so they had been divorced, most of my life at that point.
Okay. All right. So you've got, a biological sister, biological brother.
Nope. I have one biological sister. My mom was actually very lucky to even have the two children that she had. And I had two half sisters and a half brother who unfortunately did pass early on in my life. And then I have three stepbrothers from my dad's second marriage.
Okay. That makes sense. Okay. I mean, I'm putting it together.
and then you add in in-laws, and it just explodes. So we'll keep it to this family for now. But
yeah.
It was always a very big family. There were lots of people around all the time.
Mm. What were some of the other things that were happening in your home at that time? Like, what was the feeling like with, you've had a lot of people visiting. How did you work your way through the divorce?
My mom ended up marrying pretty quickly after, quickly in my mind, of course, as a kid, I don't remember exact timelines, but we moved to another city, and she had her partner, and we all moved in together. And There was where I grew up with my biological sister, Ellie. At this point, most of my half-brothers and half-sisters were all out of the home, or they were in my dad's home, who I visited. You know, it was an every other weekend kind of thing. So we kind of grew up, my mom and my sister and I, we always took care of each other. My mom was married and divorced 4 times. So, and, you know, the second one was my dad. So we had people kind of coming in and out of the house for most of our life. And so we kind of had this, like, this feeling of just taking care of each other, the three of us, you know, especially when my mom was single, it was just us. We were, you know, doing what we needed to get by and support each other. But we also, both of my parents have longstanding illnesses and diseases that put them in and out of the hospital. So we had, our family was very close. We went to our grandparents all the time. We were there quite often, either being watched by them or by babysitters or whatever, because a lot of times we'd have one parent who was in the hospital for a time or was ill and, you know, couldn't take care of us in the way they wanted to at the time. And it's interesting because I think back and I don't have any negative feelings about my parents' divorce. Like, it was just one day, oh, dad's moving out and we'll get to see him every other weekend. And I was just like, okay, great. Mm. You know, I'm 7 years old. And
yeah, right.
And so it didn't, I don't remember it actually having an emotional effect on me, which was very interesting. And I think that kind of speaks to my ability to look at a situation and think, well, is this something I really need to get upset about, or do I have control over it or not? Okay. You know, and this was something I obviously had no control over. So I was able to take that and just say, well, okay, that's how it is. Let's just keep going.
Yeah. Let's deal with it and move on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And what activities could you find yourself doing for hours at a time?
Oh, I was an avid reader. And I say was because I think as soon as I had kids, like, that habit went kind of out the door. And now I'm much more into podcasts and audiobooks, things I can listen while I'm going from one place to another. But I used to be able to sit down for a whole weekend and just finish a book.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was in fourth grade, we had reading time in classroom. And there was a day where all of a sudden my ears perked up and I realized that my teacher had been calling my name and I didn't hear her. And I thought I was going to get in trouble. Because I was just so into my book. I was reading Matilda at the time, which I think I read twice that year.
Okay.
And
I like that book
one of my favorites, by Roald Dahl. And she stops when she realizes that I've been so into my reading. And I finally looked up and she's like, okay, everyone, I want you to take note. Allison was so into her book that she did not even hear me call. Thing and that we'd moved on. So this is what I need all of you to be doing during reading time.
Uh-huh.
And it was just one of those things I remember because I really could just immerse myself in whatever story I was reading.
Well, and to be reinforced in public that was a good thing.
You know, exactly.
Cool. So what did you learn about taking financial and emotional risks in your family?
So that's an interesting thing. I don't remember financial risks as a child. That wasn't something I ever had to worry about, even though, you know, my mom was single, you know, she was working, she was a teacher and working on a teacher's salary. But I never really felt, we didn't have a lot of things. We did more activities and experiences. But that never really came into play until much later in my life. But emotional risks was definitely something that I ran into a lot. And I think really guided kind of how my life has gone. And so I had a lot of situations which get into more trauma, where my emotions for a long time had to kind of take a back seat. And there were a lot of times where I felt like if I let my emotions out or I said something without thinking first, I often said, ended up saying things I didn't mean and was reprimanded, or that I had to be strong and hold in my emotions because otherwise I would be making a situation about me instead of the person at hand. So like some examples are, I mentioned my mom had a lot of illnesses and diseases. So she was diagnosed at one point with Meniere's disease. And this was around the time that happened. And she would get these debilitating headaches, incredible headaches. And there was a day I remember where she was on the couch and she was literally asking to be shot because her head hurt so bad. She didn't want to be alive anymore. Wow. And I ended up actually, that was the first time I ever had a full panic attack, and I ended up passing out. And I remember crawling away down the hallway and trying to minimize it because I didn't want her to worry about me because she was already experiencing so much.
Do you think that was the ground of where you learned to disconnect from yourself?
Absolutely. Mm. Yep.
Okay.
I think so, because, you know, and this scenario played out many times. You know, my mom was in the hospital one time, had just had surgery. I had gone home. I was living in an apartment, and she called and was just almost delirious. You know, she was asking for me to come back. And so I immediately got right back in the car, drove back up to St. Paul, and she held my hand just so tight for so long because she was in so much pain and feeling so terribly that I had to, like, I got to the point where I could feel myself having this like panic attack. You know, I'm really worried about her, and I had to lie to her and say, "Hey, I have to use the bathroom. You know, I'll be right back." And I remember walking out of her room and just sitting down right outside it. I had to put my head between my legs and just sitting there and trying to collect my own feelings so that I could go back in there and be that really strong person for her.
Yeah. I think that actually seemed like a healthy thing that you did. Like you needed to, you know, the emotions were so big, you needed to like pull yourself out, sort through them, and then come back in to show a stronger face.
Right.
Where it wasn't full of as much emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what were the biggest challenges that you experienced growing up? I know you have four big traumatic experiences that really played a part in how you came into your adulthood.
Right. So, I mean, I've already alluded to one of them, which was the illness, watching my parents get sick. My dad, the same year I was born, started having heart attacks, and he actually ended up having a heart transplant in 2004. And because it got so bad. But he was in and out of the hospital my whole life. And we would get a call, you know, saying, "Hey," you know, my mom would be like, "Hey, your dad's in the hospital. He wants to talk to you." And I'm like, "You know, what? Did he have another heart attack?" Like, and that's like, that literally came out of my mouth. And now that I think about that, I'm like, "Oh my." But it was,
you
know, it wasn't,
you said
about
it like kind of matter of factly.
Yeah. It really, I remember this really clearly. And at that point, it turned out he had like that strep B infection that went for a while. But still, the fact that, you know, both my parents were in and out of the hospital, I kind of got a big trust in doctors at that time, because the idea of them dying was never a concern in my head. Mm-hmm. It was always like, "Oh, what now?" You know, "Oh, okay, they're going to have to go to the hospital. Oh, okay, it's going to be a week," you know, or whatever. And it was just kind of preparing myself for that.
So you saw that doctors save people.
Yeah,
was
right.
Kind of your experience. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And usually in my experience, when they couldn't save someone, it was because they had gone through a very long process. You know, I had a aunt who died of leukemia. And you know, but we knew it was coming. Mm. So when it came to my parents, it was always like, "Oh, you know, they've been fine. They go in, they get fixed, they come back."
Yeah. Right.
So, Another challenge, rejection. I was very independent. You know, I had to kind of hold my own emotions, be strong for other people. I developed this independence that allowed me to really start trusting myself and my feelings. So there have been many, many times in my life where I have gone on and done something that made other people upset. But I did them because I knew that for me, they were right. So a really good example of this is my family was very religious growing up. I mean, we went to church every Sunday. We were Catholic. I went to, you know, Wednesday church, you know, I went through everything. And, but I always questioned things. I questioned everything around me. Especially when I didn't, you know, I would be like, well, why is it this way? Well, why, you know, why is this that way? Why do you believe this? You know? And so I had a lot of questions that nobody was ever really able to answer. And that never sat well with me.
Well, did your mom go through like an annulment then? Or how did she process, you know, being so devout? How did she, you know, process, or how was she handled in the Catholic faith going through a divorce without an annulment?
That's a really good question. And my mom was less devout than my dad.
okay.
And I didn't know anything about, I mean, this was where my family, and well, I'm sure we'll get to this soon here, but you know, they didn't really talk about a lot of these things, you know, when something happened, you know, my mom never talked about the divorce process. I was still pretty young yet. So that doesn't really surprise me, but, yeah, I'm not sure at all, like what that level. But she was more of a spiritual person and didn't need the everyday church. But when I was with my dad, I was expected to go. We dressed up, we sat in the front pew, we were there afterwards for a good half an hour at least, talking to everyone around us. I think my dad at one point even wanted to be a deacon. So it was, you know, it was very, very, pretty strict on that side of my family.
Well, did your dad get an annulment from his first wife?
It's entirely possible he did.
Mm. Okay.
But he was married 3 times, so.
Yeah, okay. Well, and he still maintained his faith through it all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when it came time to get confirmed, I ended up choosing not to. And, you know, I was in, I think it was high school at this point, if I remember the timeline, where we were going through the confirmation process. And I got to the point where I had to write a letter to the priest about why I wanted to be confirmed. And it was at that point where I was like, well, I'm doing this because my parents wanted me to do it. And it took a lot of strength, but I chose not to. And I told them, I'm like, I don't want to do this because in order to do this part of the process, I have to lie. I would have to lie in order to get this end result that somebody else wants for me. And so I chose not to. And while everybody was not very happy with me for a long time, they did end up coming around. You know, I said my dad was very forgiving. You know, he would have that quick judgment and he might be mad at me at first, but eventually he actually started defending me. I would be around people who would judge me because I wasn't as religious as the rest of my family. And he, in the end, came around and was like, well, that's not very Christian of them to feel like that. Like, and that was kind of a really proud moment I had when it was like, okay, I did, I did the right thing. And while it was hard in the beginning, it did sort itself out in a good way.
Yeah, and your parents accepted you.
Mm-hmm, they did.
And
they
your
did.
Your decision. Yeah, which
I think
isn't
they,
always
they
the
saw
case.
That I was a pretty normal person who wasn't like going off and doing bad things because, you know, they weren't religious. So, you know, there was this idea that anything outside of that was bad, and that really wasn't the case.
Hmm. And then you had a third kind of life-altering experience about power and control. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. So as a child, I was sexually abused by my babysitter. And it's
at what age were you?
It was somewhere between the ages of 4 and 7. It was kind of, you know, I was too young to remember exactly how long it went on, but it was something, and it was interesting. I didn't realize until I was 14 years old that what had happened was a bad thing. I had connected with this person. They took advantage of me.
Was this a male or female babysitter?
Yes, it was. A male babysitter.
Male babysitter. Okay.
Yep. Yep. And, but for me at the time, it was me doing something with somebody else that was, you know, a little, like I knew I wasn't supposed to, but it was fun. Or, and it's hard to say that you don't think of that when it comes to sexual abuse. And for a very long time, I looked at myself as someone who was, very, I mean, I don't want to say sexually active. It's not like I was having sex as a child, but I was very sexualized from a very young age because of that experience. And it wasn't until I was 14 that I really looked back and went, wow, no, this wasn't you. You didn't seek this out. This person came to you and took advantage of you.
Yeah.
And so as a kid for a long time, I thought it was, you know, my fault. And, you know, going through health classes in eighth grade, it kind of came up where like, oh no, that's abuse, Allison. That was someone taking advantage of who you were and your situation. And that was not an okay thing.
And did your parents have any awareness of what happened?
My parents. So that's a whole nother conversation, but,
okay.
They did at one point, and, both of them, failed to take the best actions, the actions they should have. And that's, you know, that's where I talk about, you know, my mom being human, you know, who came to me and was like, you know, I thought I had something in my journal about this. And, you know, as a 14-year-old, I'm thinking, well, why didn't you do something? And, you know, now that I'm a mom, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, you know, would I make the same decisions? Would I do the same thing? You know, and I don't know those answers because I haven't been put in that, you know, that scenario. But it's taken a long time. It's something I went through a lot of therapy for. I joined support groups and I worked. And it wasn't until I actually did some EMDR therapy with one of my my therapists.
EMDR, just. Explain
the
acronym.
I have to look up the it's a see if I can find it's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing is what that means.
Okay, great.
And so what that is, it's a form of therapy that utilizes eye movements to
help
you reprocess things.
Wow. Okay.
Because I never really got to process it fully because I didn't realize what was going on until much later. And so that was a huge help.
Excellent. You also then took your experience and did what with it?
Yeah. So I became, once I found the support group that I really felt good about, I was able to talk with other people. And part of that support group was realizing that there were others like me out there that had similar situations. And, you know, I always thought, oh, my example is not real because you think of people who are forced into, or there's a lot of violence involved and mine wasn't like that. So it was like, well, mine's not bad. So I'm not going to give myself what I need to process it. And so through that experience of, those support groups, I found that I really enjoyed, helping others. And I, in my junior or senior year of high school, I actually wrote an entire research paper. It was 25 pages on juvenile sexual assault. And so it talked about juveniles who sexually assault or abuse other children, and how the recidivism rate and then how that works into you know, into the system we have. And it was a pretty heavy paper for, you know, a 17-year-old. But what I ended up doing is through all this research, I found that our local, our county had a program called the Sexual Assault Services Advocates. And it was Community Action Council back in that day, and now it's 360 Communities. But I ended up leaving high school a trimester early to volunteer with them. And so it was like, it was a training that took a couple months to go through. And I was trained to be an on-call support person for the sexual assault hotline.
Well, I like the way you took something really awful and allowed yourself to come to terms with it and kind of put the pieces together and then found a way to help others. And yeah. You did some research too. I think that understanding juvenile sexual assault probably really broadened your perspective. Like this is happening more frequently than, you know, one would like. But I mean, it opened up your perspective.
Yep.
In a way that you wouldn't have worked with this population or you know, been an advocate there had you not had this experience.
Right. Exactly. And it's interesting because that experience didn't go up any farther than that. I ended up finding out through that experience that being that support person for people handling trauma was not something that I could personally handle. I was going to go to school for psychology, and I ended up changing my route because I realized I would go into these, I would go to the ER with women who were getting a rape kit done. And the last one I did, I'll never forget, this woman was maybe a year or two older than me. And it hit me really hard. And I was like, I can't separate myself from the experience these people have had and the emotions that they're feeling. And so I, you know, through that, I realized that was not the right trajectory for me, but it was an amazing experience that I wouldn't trade for anything because it taught me something really valuable.
Right. Yeah, these are those transformational experiences that if we can do something positive with them, make lemonade out of lemons is
exactly
right. Yeah. So you had another kind of life altering experience at age 20. I mean, you've had to live through a lot at this point. What happened at age 20?
Yeah. So I remember it was, I was actually staying at my boyfriend's house at the time, and I got a call from my mom and she asked me to come home. And I knew because of the, you know, the tone in her voice that something was really wrong. And so my boyfriend drove me because I was like gearing up for something big and found out that my half brother, who was 37 at the time, had died.
What was this, David?
This was Andy.
Andy. Okay.
So yeah, my brother Andy. And he had a heart attack. And very sudden. However, what was really different about this was that he was actually told by multiple ambulances and the ER personnel that he was too young to be having a heart attack. And he ended up dying filling out paperwork in the lobby. I know my family had like a wrongful death suit going for a while, but I think my dad let it go because he was so distraught over losing his only son.
Well, such a shock. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a huge thing. And it was very sad. My brother was not someone that I was incredibly close with. I mean, he had a son. He was much older than me, so he wasn't around as often. But I was upset. I was mad.
Yeah.
I was mad that something like that could have happened.
Yeah.
And, it was definitely something that, you know, even to this day, and now it sounds like I've talked to a lot of people who are, you know, paramedics and whatnot, because I've actually had a little bit of trauma on that, like not trusting paramedics, you know, on that, like, you know, I'll talk to people and be like, well, this happened. And, you know, why did this happen? They'll be like, well, we've changed our policies now. We've done things differently, you know? And so it feels better now, but I was very like quick to say like, you know, you can't assume something when life is on the line, right?
Yeah.
It's really hard. I remember being in a doctor's office one day, and this guy had come in and was obviously having some issues, and they kept putting him off, and he ended up like almost passing out in the hallway, and I was just livid.
Yeah.
Because I saw the same thing, you know, and it was this, just this mind-boggling situation where, you know, when you have someone who is obviously in distress,
yeah,
not going through the at least checks, right?
Right.
I think there was some assumptions that my brother might have been treated as someone who was just looking for, you know, maybe he was looking for the drugs or something like that. But that wasn't the case, and a life was lost because of it.
Yeah.
And so it's something I've kind of been outspoken about over time, because I feel like, you know, people don't understand that you can have a heart attack at any age.
Right.
What we think about, you know, people who are older, but my dad had his first heart attack. I think he was 40 or 42. And then his father, his whole family, my whole dad's family, with the exception of my dad, every man in that family died of heart failure.
Hmm. Wow, that's a lot to reckon with. So,
yeah.
Are you vulnerable with your heart as well, or do you take special care of your heart?
I do, and I don't know that I'm particularly vulnerable, only because the women in my dad's side have never had the same issues.
Mm-hmm.
However, when I had a 5 or 6 years ago, I had a pulmonary embolism, and I got every test known to man, you know, on my heart, my lungs, my bloodstream, everything you could think of. And it was very, it was really nice to have those tests come back that my heart was very strong and there were no issues whatsoever. And so I always make sure that when there's anything that has to do with the heart or something comes up, I say, you know, I have a family history. It's unlikely, but let's make sure we cover that, because I don't want to suddenly find out that, you know, I'm following down those same footsteps.
Yeah. So do a comparison of what you learned about trauma growing up with those four incident, you know, experiences, and then also kind of, yeah, just the whole lifestyle that you had with your family and the experiences with, you know, acclimating to other households as your parents separated and as your mom transitioned from one relationship to another. How do you handle life challenges and traumatic events differently than how you grew up, based on what you learned from how your family of origin handled trauma and challenges?
Yeah, so my family of origin tends to, and still does this, everybody is an individual. And everyone handles things individually. There was never a lot of coming together as a family. We really didn't talk about things. And the thing I learned from that is that you have to talk about these things. You know, I didn't process a lot of stuff until I was in my 20s and going to regular therapy. And that wasn't okay. Like, I don't want those traumas. And so I learned that, you know, you have to handle it differently. I, unfortunately experienced yet another trauma, in my 20s with, my in-laws. We had my brother-in-law and three nephews died in a plane crash suddenly.
Mm.
And, the difference between how they handled trauma and how my family handled trauma really reiterated that there is a better way. And the day that we found out, the day after, because we found out in the evening that the plane was missing, and we came together that next day, everyone, we all gathered in one place. We had clergy, we had therapists, we had Throughout the whole week, we had people bringing us stuff because we ended up having to wait a whole week to find out the results of whether or not they had passed or just been lost. And it was an incredibly traumatic time for everybody. But they did this as a family. They came together and they talked and they hugged and they cried and they rested and just, you know, hung out. And that difference in trauma response was just, it really set my expectations for my family as I go forward, to make sure that when we do experience something that you cannot deal with it alone.
Yeah. It's also part of the power of role modeling, you know, like when you have two situations, two different scenarios, but they're both connected by big trauma. And then you see a one family, you participate in how part of your family deals with it. And then you have a whole nother family that you can experience this with and say, oh, what feels better? You know, where what increases the trauma or what keeps the connections to each other? Because it's okay for everybody to kind of come together and acknowledge what happened and sort through it in your own way. Like there's lots of room for people to go through the process, unknown process, in their own way. Yeah.
And I think it's important to note that everyone deals with trauma differently. Everyone experiences trauma differently. But and people need time to do those things on their own. But when you fail to come together and work through some of those things with those people who are also dealing with it, it can lead to incredibly difficult situations. I have my mom's side of the family, when my grandpa passed, there was trauma response and nobody would talk to each other. And then what happened is we had, you know, a couple people dealing with trauma in different ways and they were at odds with each other the whole time. And it's caused this rift in the family. And I tried to get people together as much as possible. I was like, well, I would tell my mom that her and her sister needed to get together and actually talk because they were both making assumptions about each other based on their individual trauma responses. It caused a huge rift.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that'll ever, be repaired.
Yeah. I think we can all relate to having people in our lives where there's strained connections due to a whole host of things. But I'm realizing it's really connected with trauma and also, judging how someone should be experiencing the experience of trauma.
Yes.
Exactly. And some people have more interest in digging into the experience to understand themselves better. And some people just never want it to happen again and choose to seal it up and not revisit it until they have to. Or sometimes it never happens where they really revisit it. It just gets the piled on and then they just become less and less functional as a human being. Yeah, it's sad. But I'm glad that you have taken all these things in your life experiences and pulled that together. And it sounds like you've had some really incredible key mentors. And we have about 5 minutes left in our conversation for this conversation, kind of unpacking your upbringing before we start moving into some marketing tips for everybody. But it's really important. I feel I'm promoting a long-term view of yourself in your career and in business. I've been talking with the podcast with people who have been, entrepreneurs for 60 years, 40 years, 30 years, 20 years. And I just see that there's so much that happens in an entrepreneurial life that it's worth kind of trying to sort things out as you go along as much as you can. And so if you have a long view that you're in your life work, that sorting out as you go along will help you with building out a stronger foundation of your life work. And it leads to a lot of stability. It leads to keeping, and if you look at relationships that you're building in your business, that some of these people that you're around right now could be in your life for decades.
Right.
And so figuring out, you know, how you want to, and every relationship needs some attention for those that are, you know, staying in your life for a long time. And so starting to think about what are those connections that I have with people and how can I give them the attention to grow the relationships in a way that makes sense for me and for them, but also reinforces that a good foundation with an entrepreneur, because the route is so rocky and unpredictable, that what you can always count on are the people that you've connected with and built your relationships with a really strong foundation. And so you have learned a lot about relationships and how some relationships come and go and how some people are with you through the long haul. And I think I would like to just close out our conversation here, because the next part of your life is kind of a big story too.
It is. It very much is.
Okay. So just before we go, are there some tips that you could give, like three things that you would suggest those who are in the first 3 years of their business? What would be the best marketing tips for them, do you think?
Yeah. So I think that when you're just starting out, you want to get out there and make mistakes, because you're going to. And this isn't really a marketing thing. But it does tie in. It's about getting out there and just going. Nothing is ever going to be perfect right away. So a lot of times people will come to me and they want to put up their first website. Well, you know, I'm at the point where I have an agency and, you know, my prices are a little higher. I'm not a freelancer anymore. And I tell them, I'm like, you need to go to Wix, Squarespace, wherever, and just get something up. Just get something up there. It doesn't matter at this point how perfect it is, because chances are really good that it's all going to change, especially over those first, you know, 3 years.
Yeah. And I think part of the making mistakes, what I would like to add in is learning quickly from your mistakes. Mm-hmm. That's part of innovation. Yes. And as part of managing cash flow, is learn as quickly as you can from each mistake and then move on. And that's why I talk so much about resiliency, because that's also, you know, your responsiveness to circumstances that are shifting. It's important to be able to move quickly to adjust and, you know, shift with what you're learning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And your second one?
Let's see. Let's go more into the marketing thing. I really believe, I mean, SEO is at the heart of my business and what it is that I do. And the sooner you can start, the better. And what that means is content. SEO only really works with content. And that means you have to be putting something out there. And we'll get more into this in our marketing discussion. But, you know, this could be anything from being on social media and having things out there that people can run across, to blogging and finding ways to put content out through your website so that you are discoverable.
Yes. And whatever, if you do start a blog, think through the timeline or what you want to do, and then commit to doing it on whatever that is, whether it's weekly or monthly. Some people are daily. And just being consistent with the content.
Yep. And when it comes to that, I always tell people, start small. Do not bite off more than you can chew, because that's the first reason you're going to use to stop doing it.
Yeah. And that's
if you overwhelm yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a key element in innovation is starting mm-hmm. small so you can get a handle on all the things that are involved in it. Good. All right. And your third one?
The third one I would say is to, this is particularly to people who are local services providers, but I'll start with something that works for everyone. And that is make sure that you've claimed your Google My Business profile.
Mm.
That is one of the easiest low-hanging fruit pieces of marketing that you can do for yourself.
Okay.
Because that is how you're going to get found before your website even is ranking.
Okay. And we'll go into a few more details about how to go about doing that in our next conversation. Excellent. Thank you so much, Allison. Whew.
Yeah. Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah, no, you've done a really great job of kind of talking about, I appreciate your vulnerability and your willingness to kind of share these components because all these things together have created an entrepreneurial life for you. It isn't just mm-hmm. one particular thing, but all the skills that you've learned in each household that you've lived in and your own household and your own changes within your family structure and the direction that you're taking your career, all those things help you become more resilient, help you to think more innovatively, and also take charge of your own livelihood. So thank you for doing that. And we'll talk with you more about the details and we'll sprinkle in some marketing tips along the way. So thank you so much, Allison, for being here. I just really appreciate you a lot and how you carved out the beginning parts of your life.
Thank you.
And work through so much. And thanks, Mike Abea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. So we'll see you all next week. Thanks for tuning in. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become more effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? This is a dual innovation process. We've been doing this kind of work since 1992, helping small business owners and emerging entrepreneurial leaders with self-leadership mastery, business ownership success, and that leads to life success. We focus on the dual innovation journey of reinventing yourself as you redesign your business. We do this with one-on-one strategic mentoring sessions. We have several types of labs that you can participate in with your other peers. Both our entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab, which you can really get into the crux of how to run your business more effectively and become more competent. We have meaningful conversations that help with developing a culture that will work for you. I do weekly meditation and yoga that you can participate in to evolve yourself as you redesign your business. You can also sponsor this podcast. We're always looking for people to support our programming, build out our programming with us, and I especially love promoting you. You can get involved in all those different areas because when we mentor, you design a better life, a more fulfilling future as an entrepreneurial leader / innovator, as a competent business owner / practitioner, as a mentor / role model, and as a human being and master of self. Every client starts with a desire to shift something, clarify something, overcome challenges, grow profitability. We started with one entrepreneur. We've mentored thousands. We're ready to work with you. When you show up, we're here. So to get started, go to wementor.com. You can also call me at 612-804-8920, or you can reach me through email, nancy@wementor.com. Get ready and take the next step today.